This is Floss Weekly. I'm Doc Searles. This week, Catherine Druckman and I talk with Marcus Saylor about the hacker's ethical dilemma. He works in cybersecurity, has a huge background in that, is an extremely responsible position, and he has to actually play, in some cases, the actor thinking of what bad things somebody might do. It's a really rich and interesting conversation we had, and that is coming up next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 703, recorded Wednesday, October 19th, 2022. Hacker's Ethical Dilemma. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Bitwarden, Get the Password Manager that offers a robust and cost-effective solution that can drastically increase your chances of staying safe online. Get started with a free trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. And by Collide, that's Collide with a K. Collide is an endpoint security solution that gives IT teams a single dashboard for all devices, regardless of their operating system. Visit collide.com/floss to learn more and activate a free 14-day trial today. No credit card required. Hey there, everybody, everywhere on Earth and elsewhere. I am Doc Searles. This is Floss Weekly. And this week, I'm joined by Catherine Druckman herself, now about to appear on screen for those of you who have them.
Hello.
Hey, Catherine. Hey.
Hey, how are you?
You're still in Houston?
Of course, yes.
Yes, of course. Yeah, and yeah. I have a great picture of the airport flying into it and out of it a few days ago.
It's not a bad airport, all things considered.
I would call it that. I'd say it's not bad. What little I saw of it, you know, rushing between, I'm a lifer on United, and I have a lifelong club membership. So I could go to the club there, which is cool. It's a clubby airport for that. So, our guest today is Marcus Saylor, and, I think he's a hard guy to find online, but you found him, I think, right? Did you? Do you think you did?
I'm clever. I have my ways. Clever.
You're going to ask the good questions. Well, I'm still in Bloomington, Indiana.
Now I've scared him to death, and he's running. He's running
up. No, I hope he's still there.
Shut down the Zoom.
Yeah. Let's bring him on. I want to rush in. We got a tiny bit of a late start, and let you know, Marcus Saylor is the head of offensive security at a large financial services company, has 22 years of IT cybersecurity experience, started his career in the U.S. Army as an information systems operation analyst for the 3rd U.S. Infantry Regiment, in parentheses says the old guard, might ask about that, served as a Unix Windows administrator for the Defense Information Systems Agency, Pacific, that's DISA-PAC maybe. I am not a military guy, so I have to fake this stuff. And was the head of the S6 Communications Department for the 228th Combat Support Hospital, held and cleared contract positions of various DOD, DIA support agencies. In his current role as head of offensive security, he is responsible for executing threat and adversary simulation, which sounds like fun, penetration testing and security research and development in its information security department. So Marcus, welcome to the show. There he is.
Hi, how's it going? Yeah, still here, didn't run away.
That's good. Tell me about offensive security, and what about security is offensive? I found myself wondering.
I think it's kind of the higher level term for the origin story of like red teaming. And so red teaming is, you know, a traditional military tactic in which, you know, a faction is kind of charged with testing defenses. So, you know, offensive security, you know, is kind of the broader term that could include red teaming, penetration testing, threat and adversary simulation. So it's kind of the catch-all for those subjects.
So a whole lot of things in your bio there. What do you spend most of your time doing? What's the, you know, do you come to work? Do you work? It's an interesting question. Do you work at home, or does this require on-site for you to do what you do? I can't guess. So I can usually guess what people are doing, but with you, I can't. So,
yeah. So I do work in a hybrid environment. Sometimes I'm in the office. Sometimes I'm at home. I think for this particular role, you typically see a lot of remote work, especially when you work for an internal team, because you know the people that you're testing day to day, you know, could be literally sitting in the cubes a couple of aisles over. And you know, if you have, if you don't have a good poker face, you know, you could blow your operational security pretty quick. So I'm a favor of working at home, you know, obvious for obvious reasons. But, you know, when you really try to emulate and simulate the threat actor, you really need to think of it from a external perspective and instead of an insider. But yeah, I am not intentionally elusive, but you know, there is some, you know, paranoia that's inherent with being a hacker and being with someone in this space. It's just we try to eat our own dog food in terms of, you know, the threat profile and the attack profile we have out there, so that folks don't try to use information about us against us, which is what we try to preach in the community.
I'm sure you get this question a lot, but Do you also engage in physical security penetration testing, like, you know, get all Mission Impossible? I assume that people ask you that all the time, but it seems like a good story if it's true.
Yeah, it's definitely part of it. I think when you guys interviewed Maxie Reynolds, who's the founder of Subsea Cloud, she has much cooler stories than I do about jumping in dumpsters and running from security guards. We do some lightweight physical security. It's mostly about kind of the door jiggling, right? So using tools like the under the door tool, where you can actually jiggle the handle from the outside. One of the cool tricks is taking compressed canned air, which I've got some here at my desk, and you turn it upside down. You turn it upside down and you spray it, and that actually creates like a little bit of a mist. That will typically set off the door sensors on the other side, unlocking the door. So stuff like that is kind of cool. They're a little bit more like parlor tricks, but physical security can be tricky, especially when, you know, there's guards and armed guards and stuff like that. So you definitely have to scope that pretty well, or you might end up in some hot water, like some ethical hackers did. I think it might have been in Houston, where they broke into the courthouse and they didn't quite have all the permission that they needed, and they got into a little bit of trouble. But yeah, it tends to happen. It's a tricky thing, but it is cool. It's very fascinating to me, especially lock picking and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I've never gotten really all that good at that. Sadly, I feel that might be an important life skill. But
yeah, especially when you lose your mailbox key and you can't check the mail. So
it's true. So I have a lot of questions, because I think this is a really interesting field. I personally feel like it's something I wish I knew more about, and I'm definitely learning all the time. But so security is about mitigating risk, right? And exercising caution, generally speaking. I wonder, do you have any advice for creating a balance of a culture of innovation, which would frequently require risk taking, that also fits in with your goals of improving security? I wonder. I always wonder this. How do you maintain that balance of caution and risk?
Yeah. So in my earlier career, you know, knowing especially what I know about how hackers operate and the tools and the capabilities, I was very risk adverse. So, you know, with the extreme of trying to mitigate all risk, right? And that's just not possible. You know, really what information security professionals should be striving for is to drive the business, to make, you know, the business operate safely, not stop it from operating. So, you know, we often get a bad name in terms of being the no police or being the obstructionist to progress and innovation. Mm-hmm. And what really resonated to me was one of my mentors, his name is Mike Catlin, said something that was really fascinating to me about the role of security. And it's a metaphor that he said that, you know, security doesn't exist for us to stop. It exists for us to go faster. And so when you think about it from that perspective of driving the business and enabling folks to move faster, you know, security is the brakes, right? It's the caution, but it's not necessarily, you know, there so that you can stop. It's there so that you, if you need to, or if you need that protection or safeguard, it's there. And so that's kind of the philosophy that I've been kind of taking into account now, knowing that you can't always, you know, mitigate all risk. You know, you have to, it's a balance, like you said, that you have to strike with being able to function as a company or as an organization. And, you know, making money, you know, staying in business.
So. Yeah. Not getting shot by a security guard, probably a good idea too. It's a risk you want to mitigate.
Very much not in my threat profile of wanting to do. So, yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Since this is Floss Weekly, I wonder, you know, if we could start the open source conversation. I'm very curious about many things, but we could start with, you know, why do you prefer open source, or do you prefer open source? I'd like to know a little bit about your toolbox. I think our listeners would too.
Yeah, I think open source and offensive security tools in the open source community is a little of a, I would say, touchy subject for some. From my perspective, I'm a fan of it, because, you know, I, as I lead a team, or even when I was, you know, behind the keyboard, which was a dangerous time, for me, you know, using offensive security tooling that was open sourced was particularly useful in terms of not having to always create my own tools and being able to collaborate with peers. You know, which is, in my opinion, that collaboration, participation, and transparency is a really kind of the open source principles. But what kind of it enables you to do is to, you know, not have to be a programmer necessarily, not necessarily know and understand code. And a lot of the tool sets were driven towards highlighting security problems. Right. And so if I'm having a problem, you know, from a collaboration perspective, there's a chance that other organizations also have that problem. And so offensive security tooling was kind of a way to baseline and highlight some of those security flaws that we see, you know, in technology and help address or at least highlight what those flaws are. But in terms of tooling, you know, gosh, it's almost like there's a friend of mine named Andrew Robbins, who also writes really cool offensive security tooling, that said, if you can dream it or think of it, it's probably already happened or somebody's already built it. And I think that's pretty true when it comes to offensive security tooling. Like every time I think about something like, oh, this would be really cool to have this capability, and one Google search away, you find it, right? So, in terms of what's in my toolbox, it's probably a lot of like customization or repurposing of other people's work. But it ranges depending on what I need it for, right? So if I need to test, you know, can something get out of, you know, some of the security tools like proxies and firewalls, you would get an egress tool. The other one that's pretty popular is the remote access tools, you know, so something that allows me to have command and control, you know, outside of the environment. Enumeration tools are also very powerful in the offensive security tool space because, you know, looking at a lot of data and collecting a lot of data all at once is, you know, it's a challenge as an operator to have to, you know, manually do that. So the more tooling, the better, but definitely knowing and understanding the fundamentals of how those tools work is what I would say distinguishes somebody as an operator versus somebody that's like a script kiddie.
Okay.
So I have some questions queued up, but first I have to let everybody know that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Bitwarden. Bitwarden is the only open source cross-platform password manager that can be used at home, at work, or on the go, and is trusted by millions. With Bitwarden, you can securely store credentials across personal and business worlds. October is Cybersecurity Awareness Month, and Bitwarden would like to remind everyone about key actions you should take. One, use strong passwords. Bitwarden can generate and store strong passwords for you. Two is enable multi-factor authentication on all your accounts, including your password manager. Multi-factor authentication is the easiest way to add extra security to your accounts Enabling two-step login on Bitwarden improves the security of your password vault with options like verification through email or authenticator app available for all accounts, and FIDO2 or YubiKey OTP available for premium subscriptions. Bitwarden just rolled out a bunch of things. First is password-protected encrypted export. Export your vault in an encrypted format using the password of your choice. Mobile username generator, it's finally here. It also includes support for three of the five aliases that Bitwarden supports. DuckDuckGo email alias support for their service has been integrated, bringing the number of supported alias services up to five. DuckDuckGo Mac OS browser integration. Bitwarden partnered with DuckDuckGo to create an integration with their forthcoming Mac OS browser. Stay tuned for when they'll launch this feature. Bitwarden is also a must-need for your business. It's fully customizable and adapts to your business needs. Use Bitwarden Send, a fully encrypted method to transmit sensitive information, whether text or files. Generate unique and secure passwords for every site with enterprise-grade security that's GDPR, CCPA, HIPAA, and SOC 2 compliant. Their team's organization option is $3 a month per user, and their enterprise organization plan is $5 a month per user. Share private data securely with coworkers across departments or the entire company. Individuals can use their basic free account forever for an unlimited number of passwords or upgrade any time to their premium account for less than $1 a month. The family organization option gives up to six users premium features for only $3.33 a month. At Twit, we are fans of Password Manager. Bitwarden is the only open source cross-platform password manager that can be used at home, on the go, or at work, and is trusted by millions of individuals, teams, and organizations worldwide. Get started with a free trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. That's bitwarden.com/twit. So Marcus, the theme of this this podcast is ethical hacking, and what is an ethical hacker? I'm wondering, and I'm asking that in part because hacker is used in two completely different ways. I mean, I think most muggles out there think the hacker's a bad guy, and within it, I mean, we've got the Hacker's Dictionary. It's an honorific almost, you know, if you're good at programming or whatever, you're good at making things work, you're a hacker. So what is the ethical thing? And it seems like it's your job, right? So obviously you have an ethical, not sure what the right word is, but go ahead and fill one in.
Yeah. So, you know, I think, the ethical component was sort of that title is sort of to, I don't know, alleviate concerns with the ideology that, like you said, hacker is, you know, a bad guy, right? So to me, I'm a hacker that practices ethical practices. And so I think what, you know, distinguishes, you know, a good hacker from a bad hacker is intent, right? So as a hacker, my intent is to help identify vulnerabilities, and use my intellectual curiosity as well as skill sets to highlight those vulnerabilities so that they can get fixed and that we can, you know, prevent breaches before bad guys get there. So the ethical component, you know, you really don't hear anybody saying an unethical hacker, right? It's either hacker or ethical hacker. So it's kind of interesting, you know, that's it's a common theme that oftentimes people think hacker synonymous with bad guy. But it really is about intent, right? So the ethics component is driven by the intent, and the unethical component is driven by malintent. So, to me, that's kind of the distinguishing factor, you know, in terms of being a hacker or an ethical hacker. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I'm wondering, you know, you mentioned intents. What are the profiles of kinds of intentions? I imagine there are ones that are just like, we want to mess with you. There are others where maybe there's a political intent. There may be misdirection in it where it looks like one kind of thing, but it's really another kind of thing. There may be almost always, I think, not, or at least often, there are financial incentives. So, I mean, what are the profiles that you're looking for that you see in the world, and how is that changing?
Yeah, I think it's very much like you would think about any criminal organization, right? So some are hacktivists, right? That's where they have a political motivation. You see, I'm almost scared to say their name because it's quite ominous, the stuff that they do. But you see Anonymous out there, that they find a political target of someone that they feel is not playing morally, you know, is not a good moral person. So they go after them reputationally. So hacktivism is one. Then you see, you know, the cyber criminals that are kind of like what I would consider like cyber mafia kind of things, where, you know, they have a financial intent. They run it like a business. You know, they ransom hospitals for money. The idea is literally like a business for them. They develop products and, you know, have customers. You know, the customers are not people that signed up for it, you know, with consent, but, you know, so there's the cyber criminals, and then you have nation states. So nation states are the scarier ones, because, you know, their motives are a little bit kind of dual, you know, both of those. It's a little bit of a political, reason, as well as, you know, a potential financial incentive that would benefit the nation that they represent. So, the nation state threat actors are typically well funded. They're, you know, have quite a bit, you know, because they have an entire GDP behind them, you know, and they have, you know, literally armies of hackers that are designed to take out targets or, you know, accomplish a particular politically motivated goal. So I think that those are probably not all of them, but, you know, that is a pretty broad stroke for the three of the major ones. And then, you know, there's the, I guess, the enthusiasts or hobbyists that, you know, are just kind of belligerently, you know, playing in the gray and not necessarily, you know, more personally motivated than they are fitting in any of the three other categories.
Which ones, I mean, are you wrestling with the most? I mean, I from the way you describe it, it sounds like nation state actors are maybe the most powerful or the most well equipped or maybe the most experienced. I'm not sure. But it, I'm not sure you're being canny about who you work for, but I imagine, you know, let's say in the retail world gets one kind of hacker, and the financial world gets another. The health actors, I mean, the health, like a healthcare place, for example, a hospital may be a target of a ransomware. I think I've read about that one, or a school, or something like that. But I'm kind of wondering where, you know, what the routing is with some of this stuff, and who's best at it.
Yeah, and it's pretty interesting. I don't know that you can necessarily put a finger on one being better than the other in terms of skill sets. It's more about capabilities and funding, right? So obviously the nation state, you know, you look at the People's Republic of China, they have probably somewhat of 9,000 to 10,000. I mean, it's not even known to us how many hackers that they employ as part of their, you know, cyber attack force. You know, it really just depends on the industry. So, you know, when you think about the nation state folks, they are typically targeting other nations, right? It's cyber warfare for them. But that there's a lot of collateral damage that goes into that. So when you look at RSA, when they got breached about a decade ago, it actually wasn't about RSA. It was about trying to get access into DOD, you know, systems through RSA, you know, as kind of a proxy because of the multi-factor, you know, capabilities that they had that the DOD heavily operated. And then, you know, like the example you gave, hospitals, you know, yeah, the cyber criminals typically go after them, because, you know, patient data and health services are important to people. So especially if you're on life support. So, you know, it's kind of their, they use that motive of fear and fear to, you know, propagate or to get the money that they want out of it. So in financial services, you know, it's a mix, right? So, anytime there's, you know, a lot of money, attributed to a particular country, you know, going after that company could be a nation state focus, but for the most part, it's the cyber criminals, the ransomware folks that, you know, do have some reputational damage that they want to occur, or they use that as their motive to get the ransom forward. You know, large companies also, you know, data is pretty important to them. So it's the attacks tend to be data centric, whether it's disclosure or, you know, disrupting operations or IT functions that a lot of these hackers go after for financial services companies.
So speaking of, you know, going after, you know, the targeted attacks, I wondered if we could kind of shift focus, because I know you wanted to talk a little bit about commercial software using open source and potential security vulnerabilities. You mentioned Log4Shell. I actually wanted to ask you, you know, what you think about things like the Securing Open Source Software Act, the recent executive order on improving cybersecurity. I wonder if you think, you know, is that going in the right direction for addressing issues? What do you think the issues are? You know, how do you feel generally about commercial software using so much open source? I mean, it's ubiquitous, certainly. But you know, as we all know, security vulnerabilities are increasing. The time to fix them is increasing. Dependencies or number of dependencies is increasing. So I wondered if you could speak to all of that.
Yeah, I'm of two minds on the open source being used in commercial software. To me, it and you guys are the open source like experts. I just kind of play in this space. To me, it doesn't feel like it quite embodies the principles of open source when, you know, a company takes open source capabilities or libraries or software and then packages it and resells it. It certainly doesn't, you know, lend itself to that collaboration and participation, you know, and I know that a lot of companies do give back in terms of, you know, contributing to those communities and contributing to that code source to improve it and make it better. But to me, it always felt, you know, like you're stealing somebody else's work for financial gain. And, but, you know, on the other side of things, and this is where my, you know, my second mind on this kind of kicks in is like, there's a lot of great products that have come out that are built off this open source, you know, community and platform that have made, you know, organizations like, you know, that are dealing with cyber attacks better, you know, like, whether it's using a logging facility like that was we saw in Log4j or Spring4Shell, or using other capabilities that the open source community is really great about, you know, creating and collaborating and putting forward. I think the challenge is these companies just can't move with the agility that open source can. So, you know, oftentimes they get caught with these vulnerabilities that come out through responsible disclosure from a security researcher or through a threat actor that's found them. And they just can't pivot and adapt implementing those fixes or those code changes because there's so many other downstream dependencies that call that library, or rely on that library, and you can't just hot swap them out. So, it's a challenge, I think. And, you know, I kind of go back and forth with it and struggle with the idea, especially when things like Log4Shell come up and, you know, you see the whole world and the whole IT community having to react to it. Especially, you know, big scary ones like that, that come out, hopefully not every year, but it seems to be more frequently, like you said. In terms of legislation, I think, it's always interesting to see legislation in this space and how it gets interpreted, how it gets enforced, and how it gets implemented. And if you look at things like HIPAA and SOC and GDPR now, you know, in Europe and even, you know, in the US, like the California Privacy Act and stuff like that are starting to pick up on this in the States. It's always interesting to see how organizations react to that because, you know, sometimes it starts to become a check the box fix or implementation. It's not really in true spirit of the problem or fixing the problem. So I'll be interested to see, you know, how those particular forms of legislation kind of get implemented or rolled out. I'm optimistic that, you know, it'll put some tangible, you know, positive, productive security practices in place for, you know, companies in the US. But, you know, at the same time, you know, thinking about it and advocating for small businesses, I mean, this could potentially cripple startups or cripple, you know, organizations that can't afford to have, you know, a fully staffed security staff or can't afford to, you know, maybe have to check the box with some of the governance or the legislation that was put forward.
Interesting. I appreciate you answering because I'm obviously personally heavily biased toward open source. Like these aren't, I wouldn't ask the question of why. You know, obviously there are ways to do corporate open source correctly and maybe incorrectly. And I'm very lucky that I've only really experienced the former. I've been paid by companies to contribute to open source, which is a great place to be. But I understand that there is this weird skepticism. Again, I'm so biased. I've only really ever been in the open source technology world. I know very little about proprietary technology, but I wonder if you think the focus on open source when we talk about vulnerabilities is maybe unfair. You know, I noted there, like, why is it the Securing Open Source Software, you know, Act? Why not just securing software? It's a proprietary software, certainly has vulnerabilities. I wondered if you had any thoughts about that.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit about when you think about proprietary software, there's that security theater, right? Because the source code is not as collaboratively known. Maybe there's a perception that it's not as easy to find vulnerabilities, or I really don't understand it either because, you know, we've seen vulnerabilities come out in mass. I mean, literally hundreds, not thousands every year across the commercial proprietary space. So I think what makes it uniquely challenging for open source is through the sheer nature of being open, security researchers or bad guys can actually more quickly and more easily find those vulnerabilities. And so from my perspective, you know, those are more like bugs or defects. We've just kind of called them vulnerabilities because of the security implications to them. But yeah, it does feel a little bit challenging and unfair to target the open source community. But the unfortunate side of it is that because of the nature of the collaboration and openness, it kind of puts a target on their back versus proprietary is a little more closed.
I had a couple of thoughts. One was going back to regulation and policy. You mentioned the GDPR, CCPA. Those, for the most part, those are addressing unwelcome behaviors by companies themselves. You know, mainly it's about tracking. We don't want people tracking us all over the place like we're marked animals, and it's easy to do, and so companies can get away with it. And there really is theater going on around that because every one of those completely insincere consent notices you see in the front of a website are basically say we're going to obey the letter of the law while completely screwing its spirit. But I'm not sure, and I bring this up because this is something I am expert on. I'm not a developer myself, so I've been writing about open source for a long time. That doesn't mean I develop any, but my theory, and it just occurs to me now, is there when you're dealing with people and you're dealing with actors who are by their nature criminals, they don't want to obey any laws. They almost doesn't matter to them. What can you do to it? What can you say to an honest company that's going to make it easier for them to deal with people who are inherently dishonest to begin with? So I'm not sure there is a policy answer to that. Do you think there is one? I'm not sure.
Well, I think it's interesting because, you know, obviously bad guys don't obey the laws. Otherwise they wouldn't be bad guys, right? So it's always difficult to see, you know, the attempt to legislate out of that, right? So I think, you know, privacy is something that I'm particularly passionate about, as you may have been able to tell when trying to find information on me. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how effective it is. But I certainly think privacy is something that we can do better at. You know, I think it's a shared responsibility, right? So individuals need to demand that privacy. But it's almost like our hand is forced, right? Because you get that consent or you get that, do you agree to the terms? And, you know, what are you going to do? Click no. I mean, very few people do that. Very few people read them either. So I'm not a, you know, legal counsel. I can't read the legalese and understand, you know, the implications outright as to what they're doing or what they would do with my data. But, you know, you always try to challenge organizations and understanding where that data lives and what they're doing with it.
You know, it's an interesting thing to me that well, there are many interesting things here, but one of them is that, you know, you just said, well, you don't read the legalese, any of these things. It's not even worth reading because it's meaningless inherently. They hold all the cards. They can change the cards anytime they want. You know, a privacy policy is meaningless. Any company can change it anytime it wants. There's nothing obligating them to telling you anything about them. There's just sort of a promise to have good behavior in almost every case, at least with the commercial companies and the publishers. They're busy selling or harvesting and sharing information about you or meta information about you to thousands of actors on the back end. And the question I have about that is, has anybody looked at the security vulnerabilities at that end? I mean, it's not like you have them at the, I mean, we all know that we're vulnerable, but mostly what we're vulnerable to is we may get an irrelevant ad, you know, or we may get a creepy ad that is too relevant for perhaps, you know. But what happens there's such a gigantic market, $1 trillion market, really, in personal information that is largely unknown to the individuals who are giving up this data, that not intentionally, it's just being harvested. And it fans out to companies you never heard of, not just Google and Facebook, which is what most of the regulators are after because they're kind of an easy target and maybe a legitimate target in some ways, but lots of other parties. Have people in your profession looked at that area and said, this is a show back here. We're trying to avoid profanity here, but or is it
do we?
Or is it of no interest because, you know, it's just a mess, but it's not our mess. It's some other mess out there. Let Google and Facebook deal with it. And, you know, we don't care. I'm just curious.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, you know, going to and seeing how, you know, when you think about it from a commercial financial motive, we tend to give those companies or organizations a pass, but we also, you know, there's a large market in the underground market in the dark web for data brokers and treating that like a commodity. But, you know, that's perceived to be very negative. And, you know, we go after those folks and, you know, putting your social out on the dark web and, you know, that's, you know, perceived to be malicious and criminal. Right. But, you know, when you talk about data brokers that do it for a business, a legitimate business in air quotes, it's common and acceptable practice. So, yeah, I see, you know, especially when you think about the motives of threat actors or bad threat actors, like these are the companies that those guys will go after because they have all that data. They've collected all that data and there's a gambit of things that they can do with it. You know, they can use that to launch future attacks at individuals or identity theft, which is, you know, also potentially financially motivated. You know, social engineering of many types, whether it's trying to get, you know, as something simple and silly as like getting your Instagram account, or getting into your bank by knowing your personal questions. So yeah, it's privacy is something that I feel like we need to come a long way on. I think Europe is starting to focus on that and getting that predominantly right. I know a couple of times I've had to do some like investigations or some hunting of individuals in Europe. And it was just so much harder to find that information because that data brokerage kind of market doesn't exist there, right? They don't sell that data or that information doesn't regularly get collected. But finding anybody in the US, I mean, you've got so many information sources to choose from. And, you know, it's like whack-a-mole if you're trying to secure that and get that removed because they all proliferate. They all talk to each other. They all sell and resell. And it's a almost impossible thing to do here in the US.
I have not heard that before, that, that it's harder to find somebody or, you know, to track down an individual in Europe because there's not that market for personal information operating there, at least not operating like it is here. Whereas here, it's this weird kind of free-for-all. It's this souk. It's a public bazaar almost, except it's a kind of a big private bazaar that the public doesn't go to, but information about them is being bandied about there. I was thinking in Germany, for example, when I've gone there, I thought, okay, let's see what this place looks like at Google Street View. Not there. they get kick Street View out. They don't want anybody looking at your house. So you can't see exactly what this house looks like that you're going to go after. And frankly, in here in the US, in Santa Barbara, where I normally live, there's often fog in the mornings up in the hills. And for several rounds with Google Street View, our house was obscured. And we thought, that's cool.
Oh, wow.
You can't see it, you know, just by chance. You know, the Google Street View thing was rolling through at times, but right now, actually, it is pretty visible. But that's, are you often tracking down individuals, or is it just as a way to get to a larger actor? Or I'm just kind of curious what, you know, how you go about locating a source of a bad action. It's probably hard to typify. Yeah, it, I suppose.
It depends. So I used to also do a lot of volunteering and community work for, you know, agencies that look for particular things that bad guys might do. And so helping them reproduce and track that to help law enforcement was part of that. But, you know, also in my day-to-day, you know, thinking like a bad guy is a big part of what we do. And so when you think about where a bad guy might start, he's not just going to pick an organization and just, if he wants to be successful, at least, they're not just going to pick an organization and just splatter it with emails or, you know, phone calls. They're going to want to have an informed opinion on how to attack that organization. So yeah, sometimes that's part of that is like, you know, looking at employees or executives or looking at folks, you know, in their roles and what they do and what they, kind of predominantly, you know, information about them that you can use as almost like a dossier to profile them. That's what threat actors do. You know, they think of ways creatively that's believable, that's, you know, motivated by potentially emotion as a tactic of influence. So yeah, that's something that I'm versed in. So Maxie Reynolds, you know, the other first person that you interviewed, were both, you know, open source intelligence kind of experts. And so that's kind of just part of it, is just knowing it's a passive reconnaissance portion of being a hacker is knowing and understanding, you know, the demographics and dossiers of people.
Yeah. I want to remind listeners and viewers that Maxie was on, and she's given us several guests, including you. She's great contact. On a podcast we had about underwater data centers, which I just thought was a terribly interesting topic. So Catherine, I know, has at least one question queued up. But first, I have to say this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Collide. That's Collide with a K. The challenge with device security has always been that it's difficult to scale. The bigger you are, the more edge cases you introduce, and the easier it is for significant issues to escape your notice. When remote work took over, that challenge got exponentially harder. Whether you're a fast-growing startup that needs to graduate from managing device inventory in Google Sheets or an enterprise trying to speed up service desk issues, you need visibility into your fleet of devices in order to meet security goals and keep everything running smoothly. But how do you achieve that visibility when your design team uses Macs, accounting is on Windows, and your most talented developers are on Linux? Well, you get Collide. Collide is an endpoint security solution that gives IT teams a single dashboard for all devices, regardless of their operating system. Collide can answer questions MDMs can't. Questions like, do you have production data being stored on devices? Are all your developers' SSH keys encrypted? And a host of other data points that you'd have to write a custom shell script in order to learn about. Think about it. If a Linux vulnerability is exposed tomorrow, how will you figure out how many machines are at risk? File a ticket with the team that manages your MDM and wait days to get a report back. Send a mass email and hope the Linux users open it. With Collide, you have real-time access to your fleet's data. And instead of installing intrusive agents or locking down devices, Collide takes a user-friendly approach that communicates security recommendations to your employees directly on Slack. You can answer every question you have about your fleet without intruding on your workforce. Visit collide.com/floss to find out how. If you follow that link, they'll hook you up with a goodie bag, including a t-shirt, just for activating a free trial. That's KOLIDE.com/floss.
Cool.
You guys have some really great security. Sponsors.
I know about that. That's why they're here. They know you're on.
That's true.
Before Catherine has a question, I just want to mention, not everybody hears the ads, because we have some premium subscribers that don't hear the ads, but they're so relevant sometimes that are, it's just, yeah. it's sort of weird, because I'm reading the ad and I'm thinking, hey, we need to talk about this. But anyway, go ahead, Catherine.
So. Bonus. So just, you know, for background, I come from a position that everyone should have some basic security competence. So to that end, and also to our aspiring security experts out there, I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about threat modeling, like what it is, how you approach it. How does your approach change depending on what you're doing, different industries you're working in, different circumstances, locations, all of that?
Yeah, I guess the easiest way I could describe threat modeling is it's like whenever you walk into a room and you size things up, right? And, you know, having some technical difficulties with my, can you guys still hear me?
Yeah, I know you said fine.
Okay. Sorry about that. So yeah, threat modeling, you know, there's kind of, you know, the ideology is like, I take it from a hacker's perspective. I think that makes for the best threat modeling, but really threat modeling is like looking at your weaknesses. And so, thinking about a specific technology or process, some subject, right, that you want to threat model, and identifying using different models like Stride or Dread, which are just kind of like scaled scoring mechanisms that kind of help you profile risk and likelihood. But essentially, when you threat model, you think of you kind of have to put your bad guy, your hacker hat on, and think of like, how would a bad guy enact a threat against this particular, you know, subject or product. And you basically just put everything on the table. It's very collaborative in nature. You need to have folks that are technology SMEs, that are experts. And, you know, they don't have to be security, you know, individuals. And in fact, you know, they should be the product managers or operators. They work best in terms of threat modeling. And you pair them up with some security professionals and you just kind of hash it out. Like, what are the threats that are relevant to this? And so once you've kind of documented all those out, you start thinking about compensating controls, because not every threat is uncompensated for, right? So you may have some things like, oh, we have multi-factor, you know, we're securing our passwords using Bitwarden. So there's some compensating controls that tend to mitigate some of those threats right out the gate. And there may be things you're already doing. But then there may be some things that you've missed, right? And so that's when you start sort of thinking about residual risk. So residual risk is basically what's left after you've tried to compensate for those threats. And really, when you think about the outcomes of threat modeling, it's that residual risk that you really want to focus on, because that's going to tell you where the bad guys are actually going to try and go, or what they're going to try to exploit. So, you know, as an organization, you kind of have a choice. Either you address the risk or you accept it. But, you know, mitigating, like I said earlier, mitigating risk completely is never really always an option. It's not really an option, because there's always some residual risk.
Right. So I think personally, again, everyone creates better threat models when you can see different angles, see things from different perspectives, from different lived experiences, different cultural backgrounds, all of those things. And I think for that reason, it's important to recruit people into the security field with a variety of experiences and different backgrounds, multidisciplinary backgrounds, for example. And I just wondered what advice you might have for career changers or people who may have a different technical background, but not security in particular, but who would like to build up their security skills in particular, or offensive security skills in particular.
Yeah. So I actually lead, you know, I head up the offensive security program at my company. And I think you hit something that's super important and I'm passionate about, and it's that diversity of thought, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, the demographics of my team are just wild. Like, I have someone that didn't even come from tech. She came from international relations and political science.
Oh,
what does that have to do with hacking? Well, it's people.
Everything.
Right? So
everything.
Yeah. Everything. Yeah. And it's not something that you would see as a traditional background for a hacker, but it makes sense. So I think, you know, I think you're spot on in thinking about that. And so what I would say is if you're on the new career side of things, you know, think about your angle, you know, think about, you know, like this particular person, she thought, well, I know people, I know political science, I know, you know, international relations and how other countries think. So I can put myself, if there's a threat actor that I can think about, I can put myself in their mind frame and in their mindset. So I guess just likening whatever what I would say your superpower is or what your current background is and using that as a force of good and security. So, you know, for me, I come from a system administrative background. So I know how sysadmins think. I know the corners that we cut, you know, that may impose or create security flaws, right? I had somebody that, you know, used to work on a help desk. So this person is hugely operationally driven. You know, they're the person that I can count on that's going to grind through, you know, the operational work of keeping the lights on and keeping things going. So it's really just about, you know, and if you have no background at all, you know, that's to me sometimes the best person, because they're moldable, they're malleable. But it really, because it's such a large space, it really is about finding what your passion is and finding what interests you. And, you know, trying to get good at that.
I love it. Yeah. You know, not to get on a soapbox, but I personally obviously feel like there aren't enough women working in cybersecurity. And at the same time, I think it's important to fix it because men and women think differently. A woman has a different lived experience. The experience of walking down a city street as a man or a woman, or depending on your appearance or, you know, many other factors, is completely different. And your approach to danger and safety and security is affected by that. And I think it's important to have those voices. So I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, it's unfortunate to say this, but women make the best threat modelers. They can look into a room and size up all the danger immediately. Not to generalize or stereotype, but it's been my experience. And I think, you know, in terms of that demographics, you're absolutely right. I think it's, the thing I want to say, the last statistic I read was something like 18% of women in information security, which is abysmal to me. And then I think it's even lower for hackers. Like, I think it's somewhere around the 8% for hackers that are women. So certainly, you know, creating those heroes and those, people that, you know, look like you is in representation is really what matters in terms of trying to change that. So, I definitely have, you know, a fairly diverse team and, you know, I think it's leaders, right? Leaders have to be part of that change too.
Yeah, I agree for sure. I think, Doc, it sounds like you have something you would like to ask.
Well, I was just thinking that. Well, I like the term actor because this is theater in a way. You know, I mean, you're on a stage, you're performing a role, you're looking at playing a hacker, you know, as part of your threat modeling. How would a hacker think? What a bad hacker think? How would a good hacker deal with a bad hacker? What vulnerabilities would you want to expose? I mean, even the idea of exposing things and catching other people at stuff. And there's theater to it in the sense that you want things to move forward and move towards some kind of conclusion where you draw the curtains on that one and you put another play on. I don't know if that ever occurs to you or not, but I have two young relatives who are actors and I'm thinking, hey, maybe they should get into cybersecurity.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great correlation because, you know, we use the term threat actor, right? And, from my perspective, you know, we're emulating or simulating a threat actor. And so we have to have that internal monologue, like, just like you said, like, I may know something about an organization that will reveal a vulnerability, but I need to do attribution in terms of what would a threat actor do to get from point A to point Z? You know, me knowing that Z exists. So that internal monologue, that improv, you know, we have to think on our feet. We have to react to defenders, right? So defenses can sometimes squash us and catch us, and we have to pivot and move and think about it from a different perspective or a different angle to try to get around defenses. So I 100%, especially in the social engineering space, really think it is acting. I mean, I think some of the best social engineers that I know have taken improv classes or even done stand-up comedy to try to help hone that skill, right? To be able to think on your feet and think critically in a stressful, potentially stressful environment. So 100% actors. Yes.
Smart.
That is smart. I was thinking improv would be great for this, but you're already doing it. So, you know, you're thinking ahead of me for sure. And I'm wondering, do you have enough people? And are you looking to hire more? I mean, and I mean this in a more general sense, not just your company. But I'm thinking, for example, the curb weight of every open source code base gets bigger and bigger. There are now 4 million code bases that are active on, or at least projects that are active on GitHub alone. There's a lot out there. I would think that you kind of need a bigger and bigger team, and not just better tools to deal with all this.
Yeah, I think information security has, I call it like Schrodinger's candidate, because everybody needs information security professionals, but everybody's also trying to get into information security. Like, it's very hard as an individual to break into the industry. And so, you know, nobody, I think, really gets it right in terms of like, how do we inject that workforce into a shortage? And maintain it and keep it. And, you know, cause folks do leave the industry because it can be sometimes frustrating being understaffed and being under equipped, tool wise. So, definitely there's always a need. But there's always a need for seniors, right? For experienced and seasoned people. And so I think, you know, for me, this is why I like early career pipelines, because you make seniors, you don't get them, right? So if there's a particular unicorn that I want, it's much easier for me to start, you know, with a junior person and help grow them to be a unicorn. It's definitely something that's a problem in our community. We always need more, always need funding. It's growing, it's evolving. Just the sheer number of commercial products out there that are security related, it's staggering. Like, I think they've started to come, like, run out of names to call it. And so they're just calling it like weird, fancy names that I've never heard of. But yeah, it's certainly, you know, a big problem, I think, in the community is just resources. It's finding people to sit in the chairs, to be honest.
I almost wonder if there's an endpoint where it gets too difficult. I mean, where all the code gets too big, too complex. I don't know. I mean, I've felt for way too long a time that there's some kind of paradigm shift that's going to come and we're going to do everything differently. We'll still have networks, but the way we're going to process stuff is going to be different. Is there a sense of that? Like, maybe everything we're working on now gets thrown out, kind of like what happened with mainframes. You know, mainframes never went away. We've had a guest on recently who talked about that. You know, the mainframe business is alive and well, but PCs came in and they were ignored at first, and then all of a sudden everybody had them. And I'm wondering if you think that, wait a minute, some big thing may happen here, and it's not going to be Web3 or the metaverse. It's going to be some other thing.
Well, I'm still waiting for the singularity, right? So when AI and ML take over. So I see AI and ML being a drive for force and change in a lot of other industries. I tend to look at it in the security space as not quite there yet. Because there's a lot of critical thinking and interpretation that goes into risk management. So I want to see a tipping point where it gets better and actually helps reduce the load on the individuals, because a lot of it is just manual analysis, knowing what you're looking at and knowing if it's good or bad when it's in a sea or an ocean or universe of normal, right? So baselining is difficult and often takes a human eye. So, but that's the hope, you know, that progresses and, you know, maybe it puts me out of a job, but, I don't think anytime soon, not in my career.
Well, we're down pretty much at the end of the show at this point. And, this is where we often ask what's one final question that we haven't asked, but one I haven't asked and is like, we made the title of the show before we started the Hacker's Ethical Dilemma. What is the dilemma? Could you summarize by saying what that exactly is?
It goes back to the open source element of creating tool sets, the open office and security tool set. And the dilemma is like, do I shine light on a problem and collaborate in an open way using open source? Or do I hope, you know, knowing that threat actors with malintent could pick up on them and use them? And we've seen it happen. I mean, we've seen breaches result of them using, you know, ethical hackers tools. So the dilemma is like, what do you do about it? Do you not do that security research and hope that the threat actors don't get there first? Or is there a way that you can still do that and protect the community or protect, you know, organizations from, you know, threat actors using your tools for bad? And I think it's a dilemma that I've seen a lot of security researchers kind of struggle with and oftentimes really feel bad about in terms of what their tools were used for after they released them. But it also has advanced the security space and security products, in my opinion, infinitely. So, you know, I've seen a lot of good things get fixed that threat actors have used, maybe because of these tools, but maybe not. Because some of the open source OFSEC tooling. So that's the dilemma that I wanted to highlight in terms of that title.
That's great. I also liked what you said earlier. I think it was you were quoting somebody that the key isn't to stop. It's actually to move faster. That's that kind of goes with what you were just saying about there are a lot of improvements coming along and it's all moving well with more things coming into the world. And I may be putting that wrong, but we don't have time to make me right yet. unless you insist
you
on
got it.
It.
No, that's right. You
that's
got
close
it.
Enough. Okay. That'll do. That's a patch. It'll work. We always close with these two questions. What are your favorite text editor and scripting language?
Okay. So I'm probably going to get popcorn thrown at me. You know, no matter how many languages I pick up or play with, whether it's Python or C# or whatever, I still really enjoy Unix command line, Corn Shell, and Bash. Like, I still write tools using those. So scripting language, you know, whatever. And so I'm also very old school in the editor. I'm a VI guy. It was just how I was taught, you know.
Yeah.
People always joke about not being able to exit VI. I have problems with Nano. I can't, like, save or get out of Nano to save my life. But I can do some fancy, crazy stuff in VI. So... or Vim, you know, which I use more these days.
I don't think either.
I approve
one of
your answers.
Yeah. No,
approve. Those would probably be my answers too. So
well, it's been great having you on the show. And I'd love to have you back sometime to talk about whatever has changed. and hopefully you haven't been, you know, you've stayed ahead of everything along the way.
Yeah, we'd love to. We'd love to come back. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again. So, Catherine, how was that for you?
It was great. This is a topic. Well, you know, I enjoy this topic. It's something that I do in the day job, and I do I evangelize open source at Intel. I should mention that I guess that's a disclaimer or my opinions.
It could
mine.
Also be a plug. I mean,
plug or a disclaimer. Both of those. I do. Yeah, and I talk to security people and I talk about security and research and it's a lot of fun. And so this is a great topic for me and I really enjoyed it. And I enjoy hearing other people's perspectives. You know, I am so, so entrenched in open source thinking and open source ethos and everything that, I really, really enjoy hearing perspectives from people who maybe see things slightly differently from me, and I think that's incredibly valuable. So yeah, it was great.
Yeah, this was solid, and you know, I think a big takeaway for me is that I like to tell my young actor friends that are, don't like their jobs, because no actor, you know, most actors are doing something else anyway. They're not acting for a living. There's not much of a living in that, but there might be, you know, there might be something in this area, because you're actually doing some good in the world, and you're keeping bad things from happening. You're helping.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully.
Companies, the, you know, the military, you know, public institutions, you know, safe. And I think there's adventure to it, you know, because it changes all the time. You know, it's not staying in one place. So,
yeah,
so
anything I think else that's probably, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I was just, so yeah, that kind of attracts me to it for too. It's always changing. You will never get bored talking about security.
Yeah, I think the security shows are among the most popular here on the TWiT network as well. Yeah. For good reason. Well, anything else you'd like to plug before we move on?
I'll have to look at who's on next week. I don't think so. Follow me on Twitter and then I'll think of something to plug. I'll plug it there.
And I'm looking here. That's who's coming up next week. I never keep up with this. Okay, I got it. Hart Montgomery. He's with the Hyperledger Foundation, which is part of the Linux Foundation. But that's changed a lot over time. That's sort of the blockchain-y identity stuff that's going on there. We had Brian Bellendorf on earlier. He was there. He's moved on, and now Hart's there. So he's coming up next week. And until then, it's been great having you. I'm Doc Searles. This is Floss Weekly. See you next week.
Hey, folks. I'm Ant Pruitt. And what do you get your favorite tech geek that has everything? A Club TWiT gift subscription, of course. TWiT podcasts keep them informed and entertained with the most relevant tech news podcasts available. With the Club TWiT subscription, they get access to all of our podcasts ad-free. They also get access to our members-only Discord, access to exclusive outtakes, behind-the-scenes, and special content such as AMAs, which I just love hosting, plus exclusive shows such as Hands on Mac, Hands on Windows, and the Untitled Linux Show. Purchase your geek's gift at twit.tv/clubtwit, and it will thank you every day.